almost all social scientists know that voters know very little about politics, very little about economics, very little about policy. Right? And I would say it is indeed a puzzle. How could it not matter that voters know very little about politics? Right? How could that not wind up having a serious effect? Well, there is actually a good answer in the case of democracy.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is Brian Kaplan, who opens his book with a great quote. And anybody who opens a book with a quote that is this great deserves to be read. Here's the quote. A supporter once called out, "Governor Stevenson, all thinking people are for you." And Natalie Stevenson answered, "That's not enough. I need a majority." Brian Kaplan is the award-winning author of an intriguing book, The Myth of the Irrational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. Brian Kaplan has been on the economics faculty at George Mason University since 1997. He earned his master's at Berkeley and his PhD at Princeton, just spanning the country, and has published in the major scholarly journals, the Economic Journal, the Journal of Law and Economics, Social Science Quarterly, and others. His major fields of interest are public choice, public finance, and monetary economics. Please welcome Brian Kaplan.
Thank you. That's actually the myth of the rational voter, not of the irrational voter. No, the irrational voter is a reality. All right. Almost all social scientists know that voters know very little about politics, very little about economics, very little about policy. This is not controversial, although many people who are interested in politics are shocked to learn for the first time, for example, that only half of Americans know that every state has two senators. Right? If you're a political scientist, how could you not know that? But in fact, when you go to the data, you see half of all people don't know that. One way or another, they've managed not to learn that or to forget it. Okay? So when simply faced with the fact of how much the average voter knows about politics, pretty much everyone who has looked at the data will say, it's not very much. So at which point you may be very worried for democracy. However, there's also a lot of people say, yes, they don't know very much, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference. Right now, if someone were to say, surgeons don't know anything about anatomy, but it doesn't matter, you might be puzzled. And you say, how could it not matter? Right? And I would say it is indeed a puzzle. How could it not matter that voters know very little about politics? Right? How could that not wind up having a serious effect? Well, there is actually a good answer in the case of democracy. And the answer says, look, if voters' errors are completely random, if a person who doesn't know anything makes up his mind by flipping a coin, then we don't have anything to worry about. Why not? Well, there's a basic rule in statistics that says if you flip coins a whole bunch of times, you actually have a very good idea about what the fraction of heads and tails is going to be. Right? If you flip it once or twice, then you very well might be surprised. But if you flip the coin 100 times, it's very likely you're going to have something like 50% heads, 50% tails. Right? So imagine that, say, 90% of all voters know nothing about politics, so they vote by flipping a coin. 10% of people know more. Well, what's going to happen if there's an election between, say, the Unabomber? Everyone remembers the Unabomber? Yes. Everyone read his manifesto, of course? Yes, his manifesto where he says, well, what I'm talking about would shut down civilization and leave only a few million people alive, but it's got to be done. All right? Now, you might be worried if if people were flipping a coin to decide whether or not to vote for this guy. Right? So you're flipping a coin and you don't realize this guy's going to shut down civilization, but you see a lot of people are flipping coins. Turns out it doesn't really matter. Even if 90% of people are flipping a coin, as long as you've got enough voters, those 90% of people are going to basically split 50-50. So you have 45% for the Unabomber, 45 percentage points of those people voting for the non-Unabomber. But then when you go to the informed people, the remaining 10%, well, I'm going to say those 10% don't want the Unabomber, right? So in which case you're going to have 45 percentage points of the uninformed plus 10% of the informed going for the candidate who is not going to shut down civilization. And you actually wind up getting the same result as you would have gotten if everyone knew what was going on. Okay, now this this result has been named the miracle of aggregation. The miracle of aggregation. And it does sound miraculous. In fact, it sounds like the recipe of a medieval alchemist. He says, look, we'll go and pour 90% lead into this jar, then we'll pour 10% gold, we'll cover it, we'll put a cloth over it, shake it, and lo and behold, 100% gold. Right? That would seem quite amazing, and yet here's a story about how democracy actually could work that way. A democracy made up of 90% lead voters, 10% gold voters, could actually give you exactly the same result that you would get if all voters were solid gold. Right now, the nice thing about this miracle is it gives people a way to believe in democracy and the data at the same time. It gives people a way to admit the facts, which are very hard to argue with, that voters know very little about what's going on, and at the same time believe that democracy is actually working quite well. Okay, so far so good, right? And again, in terms of logic, I have no complaint with the story. But what I will say is this: if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Seems too good to be true, it probably is. You know, anyone here ever watched late night television and learned that you too can own your own alpaca farm? You too can get rich running it. All right, so I've never verified this, but and if you're watching this on TV, you know, flip channels, and you may be able to find this ad for starting your own alpaca farm. So anyway, I've never checked whether or not this actually works, but whenever I see it, I say, you know what, I just don't believe that that could be true. It seems too good to be true to think that I could just buy a few alpacas, put them in my backyard, and before you know it, I would be an alpaca baron making, you know, millions of dollars with my alpaca farm. This just sounds implausible. I've never checked this out. Maybe it's true, but I just change the channel and say, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Well, I'd say very much the same thing about the miracle. If the miracle of inauguration seems too good to be true, it probably is. And now what I'm going to talk about is where exactly the miracle goes wrong. Right? Well, the key assumption behind the miracle is this assumption that voter errors are random rather than systematic. The idea that if you don't know very much, what you do is flip a coin. In particular, that you flip a fair coin. However, what if you don't know very much? What if you flip an unfair coin? What if you flip a coin that always comes out heads? Right? Or what if you just go with what feels good? And what feels good doesn't make a lot of sense. Right, so these are some other possibilities about what someone might do when they don't know very much. So you think at this point that you would want to go and double check. Want to go and double check and see, well, what evidence is there that voter errors are random? What evidence is there that voter errors actually are random, right, as opposed to systematic? Is it really true that people who don't know very much are pretty much equally likely to adopt every position? Or maybe in contrast, people who don't know very much actually lean to one side, right, another possibility. Right, so when I was first researching this, I started looking around and saying, all right, so why do people believe this? Why are so many social scientists convinced that errors actually are random? And in the end, after going over as much data as I could find, I said, you know what? There isn't really any reason why people do believe this. It's more like people believe this because it makes the miracle work than because they've actually seen a lot of facts that support this. Okay? So there's actually very little evidence that voter errors are random. And when you go and turn to public opinion data, you actually see something quite different. What you see in public opinion data is that large systematic errors are the rule, not the exception. Large systematic errors are the rule, not the exception. It is normally the case that if you go and take a look at public opinion, you will find that people who don't know very much incline to error, and they incline to particular kinds of error. Right? People who know very little tend to not only make mistakes, which is not surprising, they tend to make the same mistakes. Right, now, there's several different ways that you can actually demonstrate this, and all these different methods point in the same direction. If you're curious, you can come to my talk to the economics department later today, where I will go into the nitty-gritty of this. But just to go and focus on the main approach that I actually wind up using, the main approach that I use, which is one of several, it starts with a presumption that if laymen and experts disagree, the experts are probably right. Right, I know this is an insufferably elitist assumption, right? Many people take offense. Wow, awful. What kind of a person could think such a thing? But still, I'm going to say, look, I only said it's a presumption. It's only a presumption. This is just a starting point. Doesn't mean that you cannot show the presumption is wrong. But still, I start with the presumption that if laymen and experts disagree, if people who have never studied a subject disagree with people who have studied the subject for 10 years, I am going to take as a guess that the people who study the subject for 10 years are probably right. Okay, so now, since when I say this is a presumption, this means that I'm open to counterarguments. I'm willing to consider the possibility that the experts are wrong, or in fact, maybe the experts are lying. And indeed, we all face situations where we do have good reason to distrust the experts. Like if you go and take your car to the auto mechanic, and he says that you need $2,000 worth of work, you might say, I don't believe you. And say, well, how do you know? I'm the expert. Well, there's a case where you actually have a good reason to doubt the expert. So yes, it's true you know a lot more about cars. However, you have some incentive to shade the truth here. So I'm not going to immediately defer to your expertise. I'm going to be somewhat skeptical. But suppose you went and met a mechanic who knew he wasn't going to get the job. Suppose you met a mechanic who said, he knows that you're not going to hire him, and he looks at it and tells you his opinion then. Then it's a lot harder to say that he is lying in order to get your money. And at this point, when you say, I still don't believe you, you start to seem rather arrogant. And then finally, what if it is your son who's the mechanic? Right, your son, the mechanic, tells you, Mom, your car needs this. What do you know? Or you're just trying to get some money out of me. No, I'm not. I do the work for free. I'm just telling you, I've studied this for a long time. All right, now that is a case where I think you would have to start to be pretty paranoid to say, what do the experts know? I don't trust them. All right, now this presumption is one that I'm happy to use for a lot of different areas, so happy to use it for other areas. In my book, I talk about toxicology, cancer research, some other areas. But my main focus is beliefs about economics. Partly this is just because I am an economist, so of course I think economics is incredibly interesting. I don't expect this to be convincing to anyone else. But what I will say is it's not actually just economists who think that economics is important. In fact, if you go and ask voters, what do you think are the most important problems facing the country? Before 9/11, economics was basically always the top answer. Before 9/11, economics was always the top answer, very close to the top. And even after 9/11, economics is generally near the top. So it's not just economists who think that economics is important. The typical voter thinks that economics is important. Okay. So that's one reason is, in fact, this is something that voters do care about a great deal and seem to base a lot of their decisions on. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is that economists have a strange history of complaining about how little people know about their field. Right? Much more than almost any other field I'm aware. So economists have spent several centuries saying, I can't believe the stuff my students tell me. I can't believe what these intro students come into my class and say. Right? And you can get this out of Adam Smith 200 years ago. I don't think they called it intro at the time, but basic idea is that students of economics show up thinking that they know the answers, and often will say, listen to me, professor. Here's what's really wrong with the country. I haven't even started lecturing yet. Why don't you wait and hear what I have to say, and then we can talk about it. All right, so economists have been unhappy with public opinion for a very long time, which makes it interesting to ask, is there really any basis for economists' unhappiness? Or maybe our students have just been pulling our legs and they've been saying, I'll tell the professor something that I know will really bother him just to get his goat. All right, so my strategy is throughout the main empirical part of the book is to compare the opinions of layman and expert about economics using something called the Survey of Americans and Economists on the Economy. Don't have time to go into the details of the survey, but it was perfect for my purposes because this is the one survey that asked a whole lot of questions about the economy, very diverse questions, to both the general public and to professional economists. And it also got very detailed information about the respondents, which lets us go and check some of the main explanations for why the experts might really be wrong. Okay. All right. So one thing that the miracle of aggregation would predict about these results is that laymen and experts would actually have the same average beliefs. That laymen and experts would on average agree, because if people are making up their minds by flipping a coin, then they're equally likely to think something that is more extreme than what economists think, or something that's less extreme. It was a question of free trade. If they were just flipping a coin to decide what to think, they should be equally likely to be more in favor of free trade than economists, less in favor of free trade than economists. So what do we actually find? What we find is the miracle of aggregation very badly fails. And this doesn't mean that it just fails once or twice. It fails almost every single time. And it doesn't fail by a small amount. It fails by very large amounts in the majority cases. Right? So it turns out that in the data, there are very large belief gaps between economists and non-economists. And furthermore, these gaps are in the directions that economists would have expected. These gaps are in the directions that economists would have been expected. How do we know this is what economists would have expected? Well, you read the complaining. You listen to what economists are complaining about, saying, I can't believe students think this. And what economists have been saying that they can't believe their students think is, it turns out, what the general public actually believes. Okay, so what are some of the main patterns? The first big pattern that you see is what I call one of anti-market bias. The public is systematically more suspicious of the social benefits of the market mechanism than economists are. Economists are much more likely to think that greedy intentions combined with markets will give you socially beneficial results. Public is much more likely to think, look, if people are out to make money, things are going to turn out badly. Okay, now, there's lots of different issues where economists apply this. Right, so things like rent control, so on. Although when I was driving down here, I got a great example. Normally, I'm not up in the I'm not awake at 7 o'clock in the morning, so I get to miss rush hour every day. But in order to get here, I needed to be up very early. Fortunately, I was driving from Fairfax to Charlottesville rather than the other way around, because when I was on the road, there was at least 5 miles of traffic backed up. All right, now this is a problem that a lot of people complain about, and this is one that every economist knows how to solve. Every economist in the country knows how to solve this problem. And the solution, of course, is to use markets, to use the market mechanism of price. Look, when the price of using the roads is free, then you will wind up having enormous traffic jams. And a way of getting rid of the problem would be to raise the price, which modern technology makes incredibly easy. Everyone knows about easy passes, fast passes. Technologically, it would be extremely easy right now to simply charge a higher price to use the road during rush hour than during other hours. And this way, we could make these traffic patterns disappear overnight. Right? It would be extremely easy. And yet, of course, when economists propose this idea, generally they are denounced for being such bad people. But still, this is the only solution that actually works. Only solution that actually works. And economists have been promoting it, and it's one that the public generally rejects. Right? And still, economists say, look, but this is something that would actually benefit people. Right? This is not just a way for somebody to get rich off of people paying tolls. It's also a way to solve a problem of getting rid of congestion. Okay? So that's just one example. I could have talked about the market for human kidneys, but I saw 5 miles of traffic this morning, so I decided to talk about that one instead. Another pattern that you see with the general public is what I call an anti-foreign bias. Anytime that foreigners enter the picture, non-economists get scared, right? Whether it is foreigners selling us their products, foreigners migrating here to work, or foreigners getting some money from us in the form of foreign aid, anytime foreigners enter the picture, non-economists tend to think that we are doomed and something horrible is going to happen. Economists, on the other hand, are much more likely to say, look, a trade between Americans and Chinese is basically the same as trade between Americans. When two Americans trade, both Americans are better off. Similarly, when Americans trade with the Chinese, we're better off and the Chinese are better off. Right? And again, this is our very simple argument, straight out of the textbook, and yet one that many people find almost impossible to get. Right? So an economist can explain this very well, and yet someone will say, yeah, no, but professor, you don't understand. These are Chinese we're talking about. Things are totally different when they're Chinese. Why? Why exactly is it that they're totally different? If you say, well, there's a trade deficit, seems like that's more of a problem for them because if war breaks out, they're the ones who are going to be holding a lot of debt that we aren't going to be paying them. So it would actually seem like if anyone should be worried, it should be them, but worth pointing out. Another big pattern that you see in the data is something that I call a make-work bias, tendency to rate economic performance based upon employment rather than production. Right? So if you go and compare the economy of 100 years ago to the economy of today, in one way, the economy used to be much better, which is that people had a lot more work to do. Right? There's much less of a problem of unemployment on the farm when you could work from morning till night every day. Right? So by that standard, you might say things were better 100 years ago. However, there's another standard by which things are a lot better today than they used to be, which is we have a lot more stuff. We have a lot of products that people couldn't even imagine 100 years ago. Like you may have had to turn off a bunch of products that didn't exist 100 years ago just to be in this talk, or hopefully you turned them off to be in this talk. Statistically, something would have gone off if you hadn't turned it off by now. Okay, so this is something where again, when you think about it in terms of a 100-year time frame, it's pretty obvious. But when people see steps in this direction, when people see a company figuring out a way to do the same thing with fewer workers, which is of course exactly what happened with agriculture. This is why most of us are not farmers anymore. It's because we figured out a way to have a small number of people grow enough food for everyone, which meant unemployment for farmers. Right, and what did we do with all that farm labor that was no longer necessary? Something else. And what was that something else? At the time, it would have been hard to say, but what it turned out to be is that we built the modern world. We built the modern world with all the labor that was freed up from farms and was no longer necessary, and we still all eat quite well, better than we used to, in fact, or maybe too well. And we now eat too well, based upon obesity rates. the key point is that if we had done something to try to save those jobs at the time, we could have wound up holding ourselves back and preventing the modern world from coming into being. Last big pattern that you see in the data is something that I call pessimistic bias, tendency to think the world is going to hell in a handbasket, to think that things are in decline, bad now, and going to get worse. This is something that any economist can tell you the data very starkly contradict. But still, people like to have this idea of the good old days. Although, now I'm old enough that I'm really baffled by this, because I remember 20 years ago, and I can't imagine how anyone could consider the 1980s the good old days. What was a young nerd to do in the 1980s? There's no internet. So what do you even do in the afternoon? When we watched our three channels of TV, which were terrible, and that was what we had. Right? Today we have something much better, but we have Netflix, we have YouTube, everything you can imagine. We live in an amazing modern world that was so much better than what could have even been imagined 20 years ago. And yet many people not only take it for granted, but somehow think that things have gotten worse. Now, on the question of couldn't it be the experts that are biased, there are two popular stories here, which I will rush through. One of them is what I call self-serving bias. The story says, look, economists are rich. They got tenure. Some of them have tenure. So, of course, they think that everything's fine. Of course, people like that always think that things are going well. No wonder they think that, because everything works out well for them, so they think that what's good for them is good for the country. Right, so that's one story that you often hear. Another story that you often get is what I call ideological bias. This is a story, look, economists are a bunch of extremely conservative Republicans. So again, of course, they have these very strange views that are not shared by most people. It turns out that both of these theories fail very basic statistical tests. If you go and try to explain differences between the economists and the public in terms of self-interest, explains at most 20% of these very large gaps. So at minimum, 80% of these gaps remains after controlling for income, job security, income growth, race, gender, any number of other things that you might want to put in. Right? The simple fact is that if you have a millionaire who has studied no economics, he'll generally have the same views as other people who haven't studied economics. And on the other hand, if you have an unlucky economist driving a taxi cab, he basically will have the same views about the economy as economists who have academic positions. All right, now, in terms of ideological bias, this actually explains less than zero, because contrary to what you may believe, the typical economist is a moderate Democrat. Yes, the typical economist is a moderate Democrat. He is a moderate Democrat who thinks that downsizing is good, that free trade is good, that the economy is doing quite well, immigration is not a serious problem. Right? So he's an economist who has all these views that you might think of as very far outside the mainstream, and many of them you may think of as very far right-wing views. But they don't believe these things because of their political predispositions. They believe them despite their political predispositions. All right, let's see. All right, so just to move on to a last topic. I made this point about voters have these strange views. And again, what's particularly interesting about them is, you might say, well, it's just the people haven't heard. But I know better, because I've taught economics for many years. Right? And it's not just a problem that people haven't heard what economists have to say, and as soon as it's explained to them, they say, oh, that's right. Instead, what you generally see is that people who have not studied economics at all generally still have very firm views. Right, despite not having studied it, they are very rarely agnostic. Very rarely agnostic. It's very unusual that someone who hasn't studied economics says, "I don't know much about this. You tell me. You're the one that studied it. You're the one that studies it. That studied it." And furthermore, it's also interesting that people who haven't studied economics tend to gravitate towards the same views. For example, the less you know about economics, the less you studied it, the more likely you are to be a very strong advocate of protection from foreign products. Right. The less you know about economics, the more likely you are to say we need to put up very strong trade barriers. So in other words, people who haven't studied a subject tend to gravitate towards extreme views that are basically the opposite of what people who study the field for many years think. Okay? And to me, this doesn't look like simply not having heard the truth. To me, this looks more like having a religious attitude where even if you did actually get some evidence, you would still say, look, I don't want to hear it. You're making me angry. You're making me angry. Yes, another interesting thing. Very often economists make people angry. You can have the best disposition as an economist. You can say it with a smile, and still people may start yelling at you and get very upset with you. All I'm saying is, what's in the textbook? No reason to get upset here. and if you look at the reviews of my book on Amazon, when I was on C-SPAN, there were a few people who got very upset at me. So, lighten up. can't we just have a civilized discussion here? I don't see why we can't have it. Right? And in fact, when people who haven't studied a subject get very upset when you tell them something they don't already think, so this isn't just a question of not having heard the subject. So it leads me to the question of, why is it that people would be so irrational about areas like economics? And my main answer is that this is an area where it doesn't really do you much good as an individual to have more sensible views. Like, suppose you got an A+ in economics and you live in Zimbabwe. Right, have anyone heard about the bizarre economic policies currently destroying the country of Zimbabwe? Well, suppose you had gotten an A+ in economics and you lived there. Would this in any way protect you from the harm that's being done? No, it would not. In fact, you'd probably be suffering even more because you'd say, I can't believe this is being done to my country. I can't believe all the harm that's being done, and I know these policies are a bad idea and are going to have terrible effects, and no one listens to me. Right? So in fact, knowing more might actually increase your anguish at seeing Zimbabwe going down the tubes. However, of course, if a lot of people had A+ in economics in Zimbabwe, then these policies probably wouldn't fly, right? Even a dictator probably wouldn't want to go and adopt policies that most people in the country knew would be disastrous, right? Because even a dictator wants to be liked, right? You know, if enough people dislike you, even as a dictator, bad things can happen to you. Right, so this is something where even under dictatorship, probably matters that if people think the bad policies are good or think the good policies are good. And in a democracy, matters even more. Right, in a democracy, if most people think that bad policies are good, bad policies are going to prevail. Right, and on the other hand, if most people think the good policies are in fact good, politicians are going to win by offering policies that will in fact work. Right, so the point of this then is that sensible beliefs about economics are what economists call public good. What economists call public good, something where if most people are willing to provide it, if most people have reasonable views about economics, then the country will do well. On the other hand, if most people have false views about economics, mistaken views about economics, the economy will do poorly because bad policies will be popular. And yet, as far as the individual concerned, there isn't actually very much payoff. Right? So it winds up being very much like pollution. Right? With pollution, if everybody pollutes, the air can be very painful to breathe, as in Mexico City or Cairo. But if one more person pollutes, it doesn't really have much effect. Right? So what I'm suggesting is that people who don't bother studying economics and nevertheless have very confident views on it are not really hurting themselves as individuals. Right? Because if one person were to think something more sensible, it wouldn't actually improve policy very much. The key problem, of course, if everybody thinks that, it's a disaster. If everybody thinks that up is down, then it is likely that very bad policies will prevail. Right? So the problem then is that given these incentives, economists should not really be surprised that bad economic policies are popular. In fact, we should expect that misconceptions would actually endure, or at least we expect them to endure unless we start working a lot harder to get rid of them than we currently are doing. Good. Thank you.
Professor Kaplan has not visited the Miller Center before, and I'm sure is unaware that everyone who is here has been carefully selected. We're part of the 10%.
I just assumed.
Part of the 10% who would vote against the Unabomber.
Hopefully.
And make wise, rational choices. There are some financial advisors here. There's some bankers here. There's some students here who I know ask nothing but intelligent questions. And there are also some faculty members here who are part of that elite group who always make proper choices. I'm going to invite those who have questions for Brian Kaplan to meet me in the back of the room and queue up, and we will have plenty of time, I think, to take many questions and hear his responses. As I move to the back of the room, Brian, let me ask you, you've talked about the rational voter and the irrational voter. We're concerned also about rational and irrational leaders. Mm-hmm. Of the leading candidates on each of the two major parties. Could you sort of run through and give your view of the relative rationality or lack thereof of the economic views of each of the candidates, which seem to be falling into the category of those who make sense to the well-informed economist, and which of those seem to be off the charts the other way?
All right, fair enough. Let's see. As actually, for purposes of writing op-eds, I've read the transcripts of the debates quite a few times. So, if you were just to say, pick out the very worst, then I'd be very hard pressed. So it's tight race. Main thing I say is that overall, the kinds of biases that I'm talking about are popular with the general public and therefore are popular with both parties. In a way, I'd say the biases that worry me the most are the ones that parties can agree on. If both parties say something's a good idea, that's when I start saying, oh, gee, this is when we should be very nervous. What I would say, in terms of the differences between Democrats and Republicans, what I'd say is that Democrats have a bigger problem with appreciating the social benefits of the market mechanism. So I think Democrats have a exaggerated anti-market bias. Republicans, on the other hand, have a particularly exaggerated negative view of foreigners. So Republicans have a exaggerated anti-foreign bias. And so in terms of two leading candidates, again, so Hillary for the Democrats, I wouldn't say that she's particularly anti-market for Democrats, but still, it's quite substantial. And moving over to Giuliani there, let's see. Well, I'd say he's less anti-foreign than most of the other Republicans. So I'd say, at least somewhat better in that respect. I think I'll probably leave it there. Yeah, so, well, let's see. I guess one other point on rational versus irrational leaders. One thing I talk about in my book is, suppose the public is irrational. Who's actually going to get elected? Is it going to be a rational person who pretends to be irrational, or is it going to be a guy who actually is irrational? And there's arguments for both sides here. All right. So on the one hand, you can say, look, really what you want to be is to be a rational politician, but to pretend to share the views of the public so that they'll like you. Right. So you basically take a page out of the book of Machiavelli's The Prince, or maybe the entire book of The Prince. Say, look, I'm just going to pretend to think what other people think in order to get in power. But there is one problem with this, which is that a person who's merely pretending to be irrational, people may pick up on that. They may say, that guy seems like a faker. He doesn't seem sincere. And there is some interesting psychological evidence on our ability to detect lies. So there's another story saying, look, the advantage for the irrational politician who sincerely believes whatever it is that he's selling is that he seems like he's honest. He's honest, he's sincere, people identify that with that, and they like the guy. Right? So in the end, probably what a politician needs to some extent to actually believe what he's saying, but also, it is important for a politician to realize when what voters want would be totally disastrous, because voters have another interesting tendency, which is when you do exactly what they tell you and it fails, they hate you. So politicians need to be worried to some extent that if they listen too literally to voters, they'd get blamed, which I think is part of the reason why policy is not worse than it is. Right? When you look at public opinion, I often wonder, wow, it's amazing things are not much worse. It's amazing that the United States is not Zimbabwe. Right? And I think part of the explanation is that if politicians actually did exactly what voters told them to do, the results would be disastrous and those politicians would be thrown out of office. So politicians moderate what they actually offer, which then makes voters say, those guys are all corrupt, they don't listen to us.
Brian, this comes from a political scientist, mm-hmm. not an economist, although when I studied political science at Muhlenberg College, we had to take economics as part of our major.
So very good.
I've always attributed that to the limited rationality that I have. I was wondering why you think there's this systematic bias mm-hmm. Between the public and experts. First of all, and secondly, and you began to get at this in the remarks you've just made, what remedies can we take to ameliorate this bias? Everybody's not going to get an A+ in economics, I suspect. I think one thing I guess you would suggest is we not have national referenda on economic policy, but I wonder if you could give us some systematic sense of what measures we could take to ameliorate some of these concerns that you have.
Yeah, two great questions. So the first one's very hard. Why exactly is that we see the biases that we do? Well, some things that we can say are that these biases seem to exist in basically every country. They seem to have been around for a very long time, at minimum a couple of centuries. And in fact, you can see a lot of signs of this when you go and read classical authors. You can go and read Aristotle on usury, and it seems like his attitude towards usury or towards the charging of interest is really very similar to one that people in much later periods have had, even people who had no contact with Aristotle. So it seems to be that these biases are quite stable. And normally when we see something like this that's quite stable, at least modern social scientists, we usually start looking to evolutionary psychology. Okay, now, there's one professor, Paul Rubin, has done some interesting work along these lines. He has an article in the Southern Economic Journal on this. But in the end, there's only one where he really convinces me. I think there's a very good evolutionary story for why it is that we have this exaggerated fear of foreigners, which is that we evolved in a situation where when a foreign tribe showed up, it would be naive to say, oh, goody, a new tribe showed up next to us, let's start trading with them. When you were hunter-gatherers, that is not a very sensible view to take, because first of all, a lot of what's going to go on is they are just going to be hunting with the same stock of animals as you, so you're basically dividing fixed pie, there's not going to be a lot of trade, and second of all, that new tribe might go and attack you before dawn and kill you. So, of course, this no longer happens very often with our Toyota dealerships today, but nevertheless, I think that a lot of the attitudes that we have towards trade with Japan or China are the byproducts or the vestiges of an evolutionary environment where things were very different. In terms of the other biases, again, it seems like ultimately there should be some kind of an evolutionary story, but I don't think that we really have a good one yet. So, of course, I'd love for there to be further research on this. To convince me. So if anyone has that, that'd be great. On the question of what can be done, let's see. Well, I've got a long list, which things which vary from more likely to less likely. One piece of advice that I offer, especially to other economists, is don't assume that just because there's a market failure, that government is going to correct it. Don't look at, for example, an insurance market and say, look, this market isn't working perfectly, therefore we should have regulation. Right? The problem is that even when economists can tell you, and quite clearly, a way of making markets work better, a way that regulation could improve market performance, it doesn't mean that's actually likely to happen. And very often what you'll see is that when regulation does kick in, it actually winds up making a problem worse on purpose. Right? So for example, in the case of insurance, a standard economist's concern about insurance markets is that insurance companies don't have enough information to charge the highest risk people the highest rates. Right? Now, if you're wondering, why is that? Why is that so important? You can go to the Wikipedia article on adverse selection if you want to get the basics. But for economists, the problem with insurance markets is that insurance companies may not know who is really risky, and then they may be unable to charge them higher rates than people who are less risky. On the other hand, when non-economists look at insurance markets, they usually think how evil that everyone isn't charged exactly the same rate, and let's go and pass regulations saying that you can't charge higher risk people higher rates. Okay, so that's one example, but one basic lesson of just because markets could be improved in theory doesn't mean that it's actually a good idea to favor regulation, because very often the regulation will make the problem worse. So that's one. So one solution basically is just having government do less. Now, in terms of institutional fixes, here's one which people laugh at, but I think it makes a lot of sense, which is stop trying to get out the vote. Stop trying to increase turnout. Why is that? Well, in general, there's some very good data showing that people who are less likely to vote also know a lot less. And what would happen if we were to get all of them to vote? Well, politicians would have to appeal to a voter who knows even less than he does now. So, again, let's see, when I was at Yale, there was a law professor who was just appalled by this and said, even if it were true, we shouldn't say it. I think we should say it. It doesn't make sense to encourage people who don't know what's going on to participate. In fact, I think it would be better to go and say, if you don't know what's going on, do us a favor. Don't participate. if there's some people performing surgery, one person doesn't know what's going on, I don't think it makes sense to say, participate, join in. Do your civic duty. Pick up a scalpel. Your civic duty is to watch. Watch, and maybe one day you'll know what's going on, and then we'd encourage you to pick up a scalpel, but until that day comes, hold off. Right, so that's something else worth mentioning. Now, in terms of what I can actually do and what people who are actually likely to listen to me can actually do, here one of my big things that I promote is just better economic education. Right, better economic education. One of the things that the idea of the rational voter model has discouraged is that it's discouraged economists from trying to improve their students. It's discouraged economists from trying to educate their students and to fix them, because, of course, if everyone knows what's going on anyway, what's the point of trying to tell them that what they currently think is incorrect? So I think one important effect of the idea of the rational voter model, of the idea of the rational voter, is that it sapped the morale of economics. It has dulled the crusading zeal of economists to try to educate a broader public. Right? I think that's a serious problem. This is something that economists can do. Furthermore, worth pointing out, it's something that economists can do at basically zero cost, because we have to teach classes anyway. Right? So if you're going to be in the classroom anyway, why not talk about something that's actually going to tend to improve the quality of policy rather than boring your students to death? Which brings me to another point. If there's one thing that I blame economists for, it's for not being very entertaining. Right? Getting on TV for a minute and putting people to sleep. Right? So, and then, even when you don't put people to sleep, economists have this very bad tendency to say, on the one hand, on the other hand, even when one hand has 10 times as much stuff in it than the other hand. Right? So, of course, if you have a minute, as every advertiser knows, you don't have a commercial saying, on the one hand, on the other hand, because then no one will buy your product. Right? But economists somehow haven't learned this basic lesson of marketing. So when they have a chance to go and address the public, they often will say, on the one hand, free trade has all these benefits, but on the other hand, there's all these counterarguments. Now, of course, if I had 2 hours to tell you about it, I would tell you that the arguments for are 10 times as strong as the arguments against. But, the camera turned off me 20 seconds ago. Oops. All right, so... Right, so basically, what I'm advising economists to do, first of all, make a very basic point whenever you get in front of a camera that economists think something that most people do not. Economists don't believe what most people think, which again is a point that's very easy to miss, because when you hear someone talking, you generally assume that he agrees with you unless he clearly says otherwise. Right, especially if the guy seems like he knows what he's talking about. Well, he knows what he's talking about, so he must agree with me, right? second of all, very briefly try to explain explain the basic economic point. Again, very often you don't have much time, so you have to simplify. Right? So again, a basic point of communication, you often have to simplify. You can't give the entire story in a minute. And then a third point, you make it fun. You know, don't put people to sleep. Right? Which again, if I have put you to sleep, if you're watching this, I have failed. But hopefully I've not.
I was an economics major 50-odd years ago, and I know that things change over the years. Some theories stand the test of time, and some by empirical evidence don't. A couple of things have troubled me, and I'd be interested in your comments. One being the first thing I learned that I can remember learning is the theory of the trade-off of guns and butter. Mm-hmm. And that's been trashed lately, I would say. And the second question I would have is a more recent theory that may get into the irrationality of things is the trickle-down theory of economics. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on those as an economist?
Absolutely. Guns versus butter is very much alive. It's still in basically page one of every textbook or very close. Again, the idea here is that resources are scarce, and if we're going to have more of one thing, we're going to have less of another thing. Right? So, basic point. When people say that we are burning up a lot of resources on the military that we could be using for something else, that's definitely true. So again, in terms of why someone might think otherwise, of course, sometimes when an economy is growing very rapidly, guns and butter are expanding at the same time. That doesn't mean, however, that the economy couldn't have expanded rapidly while producing only additional butter, for example. And again, we can look at a couple of nice examples of economies that were very successful that basically had no guns at all, like Japan, say. Right. So Japan, after losing to the U.S. in World War II, essentially constitutionally was a pacifist country. With very, very little military, and yet, what did this mean? It meant that they were able to take the resources they would have burned up on their military, and they're able to spend them on other things. Right. So I'd say, guns versus butter is very, very much alive. Let's see. In terms of trickle-down economics, so there's a few different meanings of this. Okay. Trickle-down economics is generally a negative term people use for supply-side economics. So what is it modern economists think about supply-side economics? Probably the best way of putting it is. See, I'm trying to remember who said this, but there's one wise economist who said there's nothing wrong with supply-side economics that dividing by 10 won't cure. Okay, so the general point of tax rates give incentives, high marginal tax rates discourage effort. That's all true and doubted by virtually no economist. The question is the magnitude, right? So is it really true that by cutting taxes you can actually increase tax revenue? Very unlikely. Very unlikely, at least for the income tax. That might work for something like the luxury tax, something like that. But the basic point is that the lesson that incentives matter and that tax rates do discourage production is well absorbed and well established. However, there were some people 20 years ago who, by most accounts, did exaggerate the magnitude of the effects. It is worth pointing out if you did want to salvage the idea of big effects. I've often thought that it may well be that the long-run effects of high tax rates are a lot more severe than the short-run effects. So, for example, it may be that when you have high tax rates that are imposed on someone who's already trained for their occupation, probably they're unlikely to change their whole life plan. But if someone grows up in a country where marginal tax rates are very high, maybe this could actually change their attitudes. Right? So, for example, I suspect, although I have no proof at all, but I suspect that if U.S. tax rates had remained at 70% during the 1980s and 90s, that the U.S. might not have been nearly as entrepreneurial with the internet. I think it may well be that kids growing up in a country when tax rates were low were more likely to become entrepreneurs, and there might have been that long-run effect, which is hard to demonstrate, but still might be there.
Back to the topic of presidential candidates. Mm-hmm. What do you have to say about Dr. Ron Paul?
Let's see. Well, at risk of hurting my credibility, I'll say he is my favorite candidate. especially in terms of his pro-market position. I think he is out of all the candidates the best in a very long time. Again, this is one where I'll say I'm going beyond what most economists would say. I think there's plenty of economists would say there's a question of being anti-market, but he's not anti-market enough. I actually would say I think he's actually at about where he should be. Right. So in terms of someone who's actually likely to go and push market-oriented solutions, I think he's probably the one who is most likely to go ahead and do that. And I also would point out, if I were arguing with other economists who are more moderate than I am about markets, I'd say, look, you may think that he's too extreme, but you also agree that the president doesn't have that much power. right? So if we would actually would like to move in a moderate direction toward, towards greater reliance on the market, maybe we would actually get closer to where you want to be if we got a guy who's much more extreme than you actually are. Because once you dilute the effect of the president by the influence of everybody else, maybe that'll actually wind up getting us where most economists think we should be.
Hi, Brian. Two questions. First, on the immigrants, isn't there some evidence that immigrants, because some of them are uneducated these days, mm-hmm. Use disproportionate amounts of public services? Mm-hmm. And the second is, how do we change the incentive for economists to weigh in on debates? In this community, mm-hmm. I think the people who weigh in most frequently on economic issues are English professors. Mm-hmm. And I always kind of think, well, surely an economist is going to say something about that, but they never do. So those are two questions.
See, I'm sorry, could you just repeat your first question again?
The first question was about immigrants.
Oh, yeah, immigrants, of course.
Aren't mm-hmm. they disproportionately mm-hmm. uneducated and mm-hmm. disproportionately use public mm-hmm. services?
Right, so that's a great question. So several things to keep in mind here. First of all, you know, if the complaint about immigrants were simply that they were using too many public services, there is a solution that is other than deporting them and keeping them out of the country, which is to limit eligibility. Right? And when I was blogging for The Economist, I pointed out that there's lots of complaints about immigrants, and then the solution to every single one of them in the eyes of the public seems to be to boot immigrants out and keep them out. And yet, the complaints actually are much more specific. So if the complaint is that they're using too many public services, the solution you think would be to limit their access to public services. Say there's an eligibility requirement. You have to be here for a certain number of years before you can collect. Similarly, if the complaint is that they are reducing the wages of low-skilled Americans, you could boot them out of the country. However, there's another solution, one which is much more humane and much more pragmatic, which is, say, if you want to come here, you can come here, but you have to pay higher taxes. You pay a surtax if you want to work here as an immigrant. And what could we use those surtaxes to pay for? We can use them to send checks to low-skilled Americans, right? Again, if these ideas seem crazy to you, I'd say, well, this is because the idea of actually matching complaints to solutions is almost lost in people. And really, restricting immigration is a solution in search of a problem, where people know the solution and they're looking around for a reason to do it. In terms of, is it actually true that immigrants use a lot of public services? The question's a lot more complicated than you might think, because the way that the American system of handing out free money to people works is, in general, we give money to the elderly, which I guess to many people in this room is known, to the elderly, to the sick, to women, and to kids. And the people who actually find it very hard to get any free money from the government are healthy young males. Now, when you take a look at the kinds of uneducated immigrants who are coming, they are very disproportionately healthy young males. Right? So it actually often winds up that even though they're uneducated and unskilled, they actually wind up using a lot less in public services than you might think, precisely because they are not they generally don't belong to the group that's actually eligible. That's worth pointing out. Also worth pointing out, the kinds of immigrants that people seem to dislike the most, illegal immigrants, are the ones that are the very best deal for taxpayers. Right? Because illegal immigrants generally do not collect public services. Because it's very difficult for them, and they're worried about getting deported if they show up, and they don't have the documentation to actually get the money. And second of all, they very often wind up paying taxes anyway, because they get a fake Social Security number for a job, and money is withheld from their paycheck. So actually, if voters were just worrying about the effects on their pocketbook, illegal immigrants should be our favorite ones. So how can we get economists to enter public debate more and to deal with the issues more? So let's see, I'll give you the self-serving answer, which is, buy my book. And then, buy my book. This will increase the incentive for economists to write books like mine, which will then redound to the benefit of the world. Okay? It's not as crazy as it seems. So, after Steve Levitt wrote Freakonomics, there were a whole bunch of other economists trying to write their next Freakonomics. In terms of what else can be done, among economists, just trying to reduce the stigma for economists who actually are interested in policy and debate, I think is important. So when I was in graduate school, if you were not a pure theorist doing math alone in your office, many people thought, you're not a real economist, right? I think that has improved over time, where now the prestige of pure mathematical economic theory has fallen a lot, and people are much more interested in the work of people who actually look at the world and try to say something about it. So I think that's a move in the right direction, and to move further in that direction, I think would be a good thing.
Well, as a psychologist, I think more psychologists should be trained in economics, because I'm mm-hmm. beginning to see a lot of motivations here that we don't learn about. But also, I wonder if you could say something more about the psychology. You talked about the evolutionary psychology behind some of these patterns. You know, one that I'm beginning to see is something about self-interest and how the economics and self-interest play a part. But I wonder if you'd speak to that.
Certainly. So psychology and economics is a hugely growing field in economics, and that is a great thing. So you know, I think economists have a great deal to learn from psychologists. In terms of the link between self-interest and economic beliefs, here is the thing that surprises most economists, but really does check out. There seems to be very little connection between people's objective self-interest and what they think about the economy. While people tend to assume that you know there is a rich way of looking at the economy and a poor way of looking at the economy, it isn't actually so. What we actually do see is that there's an educated way and a less educated way of looking at the economy, but that actually turns out to be something quite different. So in particular, if you go and race the ability of education versus income to predict people's views about the economy, it turns out that education crushes income. Right, it looks very much like it is what people have learned and how much they understand rather than where their pocketbook lies. Right, in particular, what I'd say is that when you look at the evidence for biases in the economic beliefs of the public, the main thing is that policies that are bad for most people win again and again. Right, it is bad for most people who are commuting into DC that we do not have congestion fees. And yet those very same people would probably be violently opposed to having congestion fees because the idea that there might be some connection between raising the price of roads and reducing congestion is lost on almost everyone.
Jeff Jenkins, Department of Politics. I have a lot of things I could ask about your book based upon my reading and what other people have mentioned. At least in recent years, there's the question of to what extent do people vote not based on economics at all? So, I think of Tom Frank's book, right, which was, bad, bad people, bad, bad Kansas. You need to spend more time thinking about what your economic interests are. Well, what if people vote based upon other things, right? What if there are other aspects that should in their minds, drive their voting behavior, not economics? What would you say in that regard?
Right. So it's very important to distinguish between two things. One of them is that people vote their self-interest. And that is actually, that is as close to false as you can get. Again, you can find a few counterexamples, but that's not true. It's very different to say that voters don't care about the economy, right? You can care about the economy because you're concerned about the fate of the overall country. And for that, I'd say there's very strong evidence that people do care a great deal about the economy, and they are, in fact, looking for someone who can give good results. The problem is they have such distorted views about what policies actually will give good results. And now, this doesn't mean that economics is the only thing, and I certainly didn't want to leave that impression. One thing that I'm hoping to do with this book is to inspire experts in other fields to say, look, all right, well, economists have been complaining about how the public misunderstands economics. Now I'm going to explain how the public misunderstands my field. I think there's probably a lot to be done here. In the book, I mentioned, for example, the field of toxicology. Well, you may say, how could anyone have a view about toxicology? Isn't that just something that a few boring scientists think about? Turns out, though, that most people have some pretty strong views on toxicology. Like, most people think, a lot of people think that the dosage of a poisonous substance doesn't matter, that any amount, no matter how small, will kill you for sure, right? Which is the kind of thing where you may say, well, gee, how can you leave your house if you think that? Right. In fact, how can you be in your house? Your house has dangerous stuff in it, too. Right? How did you survive the day? Because you were exposed to one part per trillion of cyanide in all likelihood. Whereas, of course, virtually all toxicologists will say the poison is in the dosage. So, I'd like to see people in other fields, in the sciences and foreign policy, pointing out areas where the public is misguided. And, again, I think that would add to our understanding. And, economics is not everything, so there's plenty of evidence that people care about other things as well. But, I would say that there is very good evidence that people do care about how well the economy is doing. This does have an important effect upon how they vote.
The media seems to be a favorite whipping boy for many of our guests, including many in the media. What can you suggest specifically to the writers and journalists that we all seem to depend on in order to increase Americans' economic awareness?
Yeah, that's a great question. So among economists, when I present these results, they say, the media, they're all to blame for this. And I say, these results go back to at least 200 years, and as far as I know, people in the time of Adam Smith did not have television, did not have radio, and most people were not reading newspapers. So it appears these biases actually were around long before we actually did have modern media. So to go and blame them specifically on modern media seems truly unfair to the media. Instead, there's another story. Well, why would the media try to, why would the media actually promote these biases? Well, I think the reason they promote them is because their viewers believe them. And the way that you get viewers, as we know from Fox News, is to tell people what they want to hear. Okay, so you're not just Fox News does this. In general, you tell people what they want to hear, and they are less likely to change the channel as a result. Okay, now, this doesn't mean that there is no room at all for the media to do a better job, but you know, the key thing is you need to find issues where the public is where the public is pretty much willing to listen to you either way. So I mean, sometimes this can happen if you have a very charismatic journalist like you have John Stossel. You know, how does John Stossel get on TV and talk about the economic benefits of legalizing drugs? Right? A view that many economists are very sympathetic to, including me. Right? So how is it that he's able to go on national TV and tell people something that is abhorrent to most people, as we know? I think the answer is John Stossel is just such a likable guy. Just such a wonderful human being that everyone wants to be his friend. He seems so nice and funny that he can say things that appall people and get away with it. Right? So, one of my flippant solutions to how we could get much better media is if we could just clone John Stossel. So we could get 100 John Stossels on the news. I think that would be a great help. But anyway, I would say, in general, while the media is facing a tight constraint of to a large extent they have to tell their customers what they want to hear. Still, there is some flexibility. And so what I do ask is, if you do have some slack, if you do have some flexibility, use it wisely. Right, use it to try to raise the level of public debate. Use it to try to correct some misconceptions. Again, of course, if you do this too much, you're going to get fired, and then you're going to come and blame me. So why did I listen to you? But this doesn't mean that there's absolutely nothing you can do. And again, if you've got a great personality, maybe you can figure out a way to package ideas that seem unpalatable in a way that actually people will buy. Which again, Sean Stossel's done. I don't know how he does it, but I'm amazed.
Brian Kaplan opens his great book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies, with another cool quote. The serious fact is that the bulk of the really important things economics has to teach are things that people would see for themselves if they were willing to see. Brian Kaplan has helped us open our eyes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.